I'm trying, I know I can't remember after going through this script here, so I just want to say his name very quickly before I forgot what it was.
I think we will.
Yeah, Senate Resources come to order. Time is 8:05. Apologize for the late start. We have all members present, starting with Green, McGuire, Stevens, Huggins, my good friend Bert Stedman, and nice tie, Senator Wilikowski. Welcome again, Senator Wagner. And today we have a cast of characters, which, as I see, is Mr. George again, Mr. Guerra again, Mr. Marks is new, Mr. already said the name, I say it again. Michael Williams, Patrick Galvin, the All-Star, Ms. Marcia Davis, and Mr. Kevin Banks. And as I understand it, we have two additional people, which we're going to lead off with,
yes,
and honoring their time today. Kevin Brooks and Ms. Nikki Neal to talk about. Him?
Banks?
Him? Sorry about
that.
Yep, there we go.
Thank you, ma'am.
Kevin, you mean Kevin Banks?
Oh, you were right. Sorry.
No. Kevin Brooks. Kevin Brooks. To talk about personnel. And before we go into the conversation about hiring, I got a call the other day about, my goodness, we're paying all you guys overtime. So my question for revenue, who are we? Who did we pay for overtime on the holiday in the state?
Well,
you don't have to answer that. I know that you probably don't know who they all are.
I think we're okay because I think given that I was copying last night till 4 in the morning.
Right.
And
we pay overtime to Patty with me.
To come in on a holiday. We had one individual.
What? The state. That's across. I'm talking about not just revenue. I'm talking about across the state.
Yeah.
Okay, one person. All right, so everybody can hear that. And the legislature had zero to include the staffers because it did. They're on a straight salary factor, so the answer is that question. With that, we're prepared to listen to you about the hiring or the process of attaining new, highly qualified auditors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and with me this morning is Nikki Neal, our Director of Personnel and Labor Relations. And we understand you had some questions about positions and maybe specifically positions that would be moving from the classified service to the fully exempt service as contemplated in the bill. I don't know if there were specific questions you'd like us to address.
Let's review it quickly. I think, first of all, we as a body are interested in what courses of action and what tools you have at your disposal to attain, hire new or people to be auditors. And, of course, one of the arms that we talked specifically about that to some limited degree was some degree of outsourcing for some period of time. And what constraints you have in exercising, what you would really like to do if you weren't constrained.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, with that, I guess we'll kind of tag team it here, and I'll start off and then hand it off to Nikki. But last year, in the last couple of years, we have been looking at generally hard-to-fill positions with the state, and we have implemented a process that we've called market-based pay analysis, and we've gone through and where there's demonstrated recruitment difficulty, meeting a certain set of criteria, we then go out and we do a survey of how those positions are being paid. And then we have adjusted pay for a number of individuals. Some of the ones you may have heard about are revenue auditors specifically. We've raised them two ranges, which was a 15% adjustment. We've also raised nurses. We've raised engineers and architects, a number of other job families in the state system that have been identified as having recruitment difficulties, recruitment and retention difficulties. That's been effective to some extent. I think we have had demonstrated success in hiring in some of those families. Unfortunately, in these revenue auditor positions, we have not seen the success as we have in some others. It also creates some issues where you have, as you start to kind of pick families out in the system, you then end up with managers and other supervisors who have subordinates who make more than them. In the pay system, that creates some problems, and so we have a supervisor differential to account or to adjust a supervisor's pay if they have someone who's been bumped up through other means to either make as much or more as a supervisor. So it kind of sets off a trickle effect of other unanticipated outcomes. And so that has been problematic. You know, we continue to look at those hard-to-fill positions and try and address them. At the same time, we have an administrative order that the governor issued, Administrative Order 237, where we're looking at recruitment and retention issues more holistically and trying, and that's a process that's ongoing. We don't really have any outcomes from that yet. We have recommendations going to the governor on that on November 1st, but those aren't going to...
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
We'll have recommendations to the governor from that work group, but it's a sub-cabinet. And those will go to the governor on the 1st of November. But none of these will address the immediate needs that the Department of Revenue and the Department of DNR or Natural Resources have related to these specific auditors. To put it in some context, I think we have 23 individuals. This is what we're talking about here. I think six, if my memory serves me, 17 in revenue, six of them in Natural Resources. So
what's the vacancies? What's the vacancies?
We have.
I think it's seven and five is what I recollect.
Five, two, and we have
five in revenue, two in DNR.
Okay.
So in those positions, they've been vacant for a long time, and there has been difficulty in filling those. So I think what the bill contemplates is that any incumbent in one of these positions would have a choice whether they wanted to move to the exempt service or the stay in the classified service. So no one would be forced into this decision. I think it's also worth noting that there's a number of professionals throughout government that are in the exempt service. It's not that uncommon. We have, even within the Department of Revenue, there's investment officers, there's medical professionals in the Department of Health and Social Services, and entire entities like Alaska Housing Finance, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. So there are political appointments. Myself and Nikki, we both serve at the pleasure of the commissioner and ultimately the governor, but there's a lot of exempt employees in government who are not political in nature. They're more professional in nature. So I think that was the focus of identifying these revenue auditors.
Yeah. Just for order of magnitude, when you're describing they're not political, but turnover is turnover no matter what the reason is. And I look at my good friend Marcia Davis, and she's new. I look at the commissioner of revenue, he's new. And on and on and on. So there is a migrating factor when you have a change of administrations, and we have, for whatever reason, we have to address the potential for migration of people and retention more important. So my question for you, from a personnel standpoint, if you look at Department of Revenue and administration where you work, what was that migration factor with the change of administrations? The number, a rough number.
Mr. Chairman, a rough number. I think. In the Department of Administration, there's a commissioner, two deputies, two special assistants, about a dozen, 12 to 15 directors. Nikki's a new director. I held over. I was fortunate enough to retain my job. But we have a new commissioner. I'd say out of those 20 or so individuals, there was probably at least two-thirds retained their positions, and these are political appointments in the sense that they're division directors or commissioner's office staff. So,
yeah. Could you just break those numbers down so we give them to the committee,
yeah,
so they understand?
We could certainly give you
some definition
for those appointed staff in the Department of Administration, and
right,
we could provide that very easily.
Okay.
But again, that's a distinguishing the type of folks we have in the Department of Administration with, where you have these fully exempt professional type employees, and those don't, I mean, not to say there isn't any turnover, I don't want to mislead or mischaracterize, but you don't see the same, I guess, level of turnover in those types of professional exempt positions that you would in a more political appointed position such as my own.
Okay. So would you restate one more time the three primary mechanisms you have to hire, get us new auditors? Restate that.
Yeah, we could hire them as they are, classified employees, and we're having difficulty. I mean, I think the reason you're seeing them in the bill is because of we've had difficulty in filling those positions. We could make them fully exempt, and that would allow us to pay them basically what the market would require to pay. I mean, we would have flexibility on the salary schedule and the salary tables to pay market rate. And then the third option would be contracting out. And I wanted to address that briefly as well. Current union contracts for the general government contract as well as the supervisory contract require the state to do a feasibility study before we can contract out any position. We need to do a feasibility study to determine if it's more or less expensive to do it with state employees. Well, by the nature of these positions, we're already acknowledging that we're going to have to pay a higher rate than we can, say, arrange 24 or whatever these revenue auditors are. And so we couldn't pencil out a feasibility study as long as these positions are in the classified service. If they're fully exempt, it would give us an option of saying we could hire a person or we could contract for a very specific period of time for as long as the position is needed, and then it's not, you know, it's not a continuing full-time position on the state position count, if you will, if you've contracted that out for the period of time needed for this effort. The only way we feel we can get to that contracting out option and have that in the toolbox is if the positions are fully exempt as contemplated by the bill.
Does this require some negotiation or conversations with the bargaining unit?
It would not. If we are trying to change existing incumbents, it would require some discussion. And typically there's a process where if you want to move a classified position to the partially exempt or exempt service, they need to go before the personnel board, and they have to meet the statutory definitions of that. So as long as we're focusing on vacant positions, it would not require any negotiation or any other discussion like or similar discussion with the unions.
So let's just say that you set the appropriate grade level classified position for a pay scale that would in fact attract the people that we want. What prevents you from doing that in the classified system?
Yeah,
I mean, can we anoint you to do that with some degree of legislation that?
Yeah, that gets into a technical level that I think I'll ask Nikki to address. It's kind of like work for like pay and trying to keep things aligned within the system. So I'll hand that off to.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Nikki Neal, and I am the Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. Currently, compensation for state employees is based on a threefold process. So we have to consider the classification plan, the pay plan, and then the compensation schedule, which is created through collective bargaining or statute. And the parameters of the state's pay plan it must be based on the position classification plan. It must also provide for fair and reasonable compensation for services rendered and reflect the principle of like pay for like work. It somewhat ties our hands in that when we look at like pay.
I'm sorry, when you read some language, what ties your hands?
The statutes that require us to pay for like work, based on that, we set salaries based on internal alignment. So when we establish job families, which the revenue and audit group is a job family, we have to pay them comparable to other levels of responsibility in other job families. So what we have are eight factors that we consider in making that determination. So we have very little flexibility, and last year in 2006 we implemented the market-based pay process, which is what Kevin previously mentioned. And that's what allowed us the flexibility to grant the revenue auditors the two range increase. Other than that, we don't have any process in place to increase their salaries beyond that point.
Let's just take the W word, waiver, which is prevalent in our society. And is there a mechanism to grant you a waiver, a one-time waiver, for a period of time to do the adjusting you're talking about potentially?
A waiver, Mr. Chairman, a statutory waiver, is that what you're saying?
Whatever. I mean, you're in the personnel business. Whatever waiver, is there a waiver that would work that we could grant for you? We're just looking for mechanisms that create some diversity of courses of action that are functional.
I think, Mr. Chairman, the language contemplated in the bill is just that. It's a waiver to the process that we work under. And I guess I'll add to Nikki's comment on, we did the market-based pay adjustment, and one of the challenges we have is that we can't be as surgical or precise as we might like to be. So when we bump the revenue auditors two ranges, we had to address the whole family that they belonged in. And so we had to adjust the pay for over 60 positions to get at this group that we are trying to target, which we've identified as 23 or so. And so you had auditors, internal auditors in different departments that also got this two-range bump because our hands were tied in working with that family. And then we got into some of the other challenges of having subordinates making more than their managers that supervise them and those kinds of things. So the language of the bill was very specific in saying these positions and their immediate supervisor, and it gets at the challenges that we've had in trying to address this over the past year or two.
Okay, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. just one experience that I've had, hearing officers, you have a job classification for hearing officers. You have a separate job classification for workers' compensation hearing officers. And for years, workers' comp do exactly the same type of job for all intents and purposes, but workers' comp hearing officers get paid less than regular hearing officers, rightly or wrongly, that's the way it is. I know you did a classification review a few years ago, you bumped them up, they still make less than regular hearing officers. But the point I'm getting at is, and I'm not saying this is the solution, but one thing to consider is having an oil and gas auditor position and then having a separate auditor position. And that way you have two job classifications. I don't know how different the jobs are, but that's just one suggestion that I would propose that you think about. And have you talked with the bargaining unit to discuss possible solutions?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we have not spoken with the unions ourselves. The positions obviously reside in the Department of Revenue and the Natural Resources, but we have not spoken with the union. It really is an issue that we have to deal with it from the executive branch side. I mean, it's not to say that we don't consult or talk with the unions about it, but your comment on setting them out in a separate family, that's exactly what we tried to do when we did the market-based pay analysis last year. We said, well, can't we set up these revenue oil and gas auditors in their own family and then just deal with them in the way the criteria and the statute is set out? It doesn't permit us to do that because you have this like pay for like work. You have auditor work, in its most basic sense, is auditor work. Now, we've identified this subgroup of these oil and gas revenue auditors as unique to our circumstances in Alaska at this day and age, but they still fall within that family. And so we tried the very thing you suggested, and it wasn't something that we could attain with the market-based pay adjustment that we did. And so that was that resulted in about 60 positions getting that adjustment, as I indicated, instead of these 20 so that we're trying to focus on. The other thing is that two ranges and 15% is what we did for these positions, and that's just not adequate to address the need that we have. And so, again, it's not that we haven't considered or tried other options. And the first one we did was trying to separate them out, but it's just not, it's not possible the way it's laid out. And I don't know of an exemption or a waiver, as you indicated, Senator Huggins, that would allow us to do that other than just taking this group of employees and recognizing that they are different. They're highly skilled professional employees that we need to pay a market rate for. And it's going to be significantly more than the two ranges that we would bump them through the tools that we have. And deal with it for this period of time, and then contract out as necessary. And then,
yeah.
And then
on the other hand, and I just want to point out, I think you probably realize it, but I'll just remind all of us that if, throughout Alaska, this is my opinion, and if you go to the lower 48, the federal government, and you ask people about would they rather have a hiring process or a political appointments, it's a hands down winner. They want people to go through a process and not me or you selecting them in a political appointment process. And I think they have a good point, and I agree with them. And for us now to be going in the other direction and creating a larger pool, it makes me to some degree wonder why we do that if we have other mechanisms to do that. And I guess I'm still, my gut feeling is we may not have explored the other avenues to the extent that's available. I don't know that. Here's my instinct.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on the one comment, this process does not negate a hiring process at all. There are still going to be minimum requirements and selection criteria and things that you need in these positions.
Call appointment. Yeah, I understand. I hear you, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Well, no, I said this yesterday, and I'll say it again. Having been in that situation, I do not think these positions should be positions where the person can be fired at the will of the governor. I just think that's a very dangerous road to go down. That being said, just the whole tenor of this conversation makes me nervous. I don't like the idea that the executive branch, having been your party to a collective bargaining agreement,
yes,
and that's labor and management, and if there's a problem with that agreement, you need to sit down with labor and try to work it out. And I'm not hearing that you've done that, and that disappoints me. And so I guess what I would suggest is that you go back and sit down with labor, because a lot of times you can do letters of agreement, you can do letters of understanding to try to work out a solution to this problem before you come and run to the legislature and ask us to change the law to suit your needs.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I mean, I'm quite confident that you wouldn't come before this committee today if you hadn't spent hours and hours and hours thinking about this problem. And with all due respect, I mean, I think that it's a thoughtful approach, and I think that there aren't easy answers. You're talking about a world market. These are people that are sought after by huge companies. For millions, for a lot of money. And we want, you know, these people to be here to guard our state books and to make sure that we're getting the return on our resource. And so I just think we need to be careful.
Okay.
I'm sure you've been thoughtful about it.
Senator Green?
Yeah, somehow if we're going through this exercise to figure out how to hire these people and how to get them on our payroll so that they can do exactly what Senator McGuire said, protect our interest, it's antithetical, I guess, to think that someone's going to come in and then wipe the board clean of all these people that we've worked so hard to get in our ranks. It's highly unlikely that someone's going to say, oh, I don't agree with you, therefore you're gone. I mean, because we have exempt positions all over government that I'm sure every day someone disagrees with them and they aren't removed from their job. And I somehow I'm not as concerned about that as some might be.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got kind of two parts, but maybe could you kind of, for the people of the state, kind of put some parameters on what kind of dollars we're talking about? Are we talking about, I'm not talking about the cost of your employees, I'm talking about the cost of what they're working on, the auditors. Are we talking about thousands of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars?
Yeah.
What's on the table?
Keep going.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'm sure you've heard the testimony from the folks in this room more than I. My understanding is it's billions, so.
Yes.
Okay. And so if we're looking in the range of hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, one of the discussions I think we need to have as a policy matter is if we need help from some international accounting firm to help us as we come up to speed with PPT or this, with the tweaks of this bill, whatever we decide to do, while we gear up an internal auditing system. One of the concerns I have is when we go out and we do these hires, we're up against three of the most sophisticated international oil companies in the world, and we need to be on an equal footing as much as we can. So at some point, we need to have that discussion before I will seriously consider opening up these parameters to the administration and taking it completely internal, because I am concerned that we use all available methods to us to protect the state's interest. And quite frankly, I'm not concerned if it's going to cost us a little bit more to go outside for a couple of years and help with some help till we get up to speed, when we're looking at hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars on the table.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think that's exactly spot on to what's trying to be accomplished with this section of the bill, to provide those tools that you're talking about so that we're on an equal footing.
But thank you very much. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I thought Nikki Neal had a comment that she might, or an answer to one of the questions that Senator Wilkowski had brought up.
Yeah, Nikki.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we're always in communication with the collective bargaining representatives. However, in this particular case, the classification process is not something that we bargain with them, and it's not a mandatory subject of bargaining, and we've held that close. And so part of the range assignment, the salary assignment process, is through the classification process. So that's not something we bargain with the unions. We do bargain, of course, you know, cost of living increases and increases to the salary schedule. But the Division of Personnel has responsibility outside of that process to make range assignments. So that's why we haven't attempted to negotiate on increasing the ranges of these auditors with the unions, because we don't negotiate on that topic.
I know a little bit about how the process works, but the union or you can unilaterally say we want to have a range reclassification, right? You can do that every year.
Uh-huh.
And you could do that in this case, a range reclassification.
We do reclassify positions regularly, but within our classification plan. So if we just said, oh, we're going to take the auditors and make them range 28, 29, then we wouldn't be complying with the statute for like pay for like work. So comparing across with other job class families, we wouldn't be paying like pay for like work.
What about for setting up different, what if you wanted to set up different job classifications? Pull out and make oil and gas auditors one position and then other oil and gas auditors a separate position.
And we actually do have separate job classes currently for oil and gas auditors, but what we have to do is look at our eight factors. And when we compare them to others that contain those same or similar factors, as far as level of responsibility and that sort of thing, we have to pay them comparably with those other positions. And so that's what we've done.
What section of the statute are the eight factors?
3925.150, parent 2.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome Senator Elton. Thanks for your motivation on a Saturday morning as we march on our 7-day-a-week journey here. Thank you. We will be asking you probably to come back. We have one question from Senator Wagner, but then we'll give you 2 minutes or less to say anything, wild card you want to, as it pertains to this particular subject. Senator Wagner.
I understand like pay for like work. Okay. In your classification for auditors, how many levels do you have?
For the oil and gas revenue auditors, we have 4 different levels.
Then why are we looking at the ACES clause that allows the hiring of auditors without creating another class? Because these people do have skills, and their skill level is supposedly higher than the other oil and gas auditors that we currently have on staff or the classifications we have. I don't understand the problem, really. It seems to me like we should be flexible enough that we can create a higher classification for these auditors we need without tipping over the ship.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, you're correct that if the level of work is higher, we should be able to set a higher range. That's very true. That's not what's been, that's not our understanding of the situation, though. We're not, and we would need to discuss more in order to make a determination on that of what the work it actually is with the Department of Revenue. But that's, it's not my understanding that it differs significantly from some of the other auditors. The nature of the work, I believe, is the same. But like I said, we'd have to have more discussion with Department of Revenue on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Just those 8 factors, I'm looking at 3925, 152. I'm not seeing the 8 factors.
Oh, and I apologize. The 8 factors aren't there. The statute that references like pay for like work is the one I provided you. 8 factors is part of our classification, the system that we use. And that is actually in the Alaska Administrative Manual.
Okay. What? Can you just give me that section, or can I get a copy of that?
I can provide it to you. I don't have it right now.
All right. And close the loop with Senator Wilkowski, you know, after the fact here in the meeting. So, Kevin.
Mr. Chairman, we've said our piece. If there's no further questions, I think we're happy to let you get on with
bigger things. Like I said, we probably will call upon you in the not-too-distant future. Would ask you to maintain your minimum agility in looking at this subject because, it's kick over with any tools you have available to see what potential we might have. But we thank you very much, and we appreciate your hard work. You have a tough task, and we don't want to make it any more difficult. Thank you. We're all in this together.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thanks. Too quiet in your marches.
I know, I better speak. Say something. Senator Huggins, thank you for having us on your Saturday. And again, a deep appreciation. I know how difficult it is for you to come in on weekends and be away from your family. Today is a day we've reserved to talk about Alaska global competitiveness. And again, anytime the legislature considers doing something with the tax structure, the production tax levels, one of the first questions you want to ask yourself is, if we change anything, what does it do to Alaska's ability to compete with other jurisdictions for investment dollars? And so we certainly asked ourselves that question when we were asked to look at the tax and consider making recommendations.
Marcia, let me stop you for a moment. We have multiple documents in front of us.
The document that you'll be looking at first is the one that has the ACES on the top of it. And then following that will be the handout from PFC by Kirsten Bucherfinger. Just to give you a preview of sort of how the day is going to be divided, or the morning is going to be divided, we have 3 sections. The first section is going to be presented by Roger Marks, economist with Department of Revenue, and he's going to walk you through the overall concept of government take. As you recall, when Mr. Van Mieres and Mr. Johnston spoke to the legislative body the other day, they had great concern about what they'd seen last go around in how different companies and different consultants talked about government take, and everybody had sort of their comparison of what to look for government take. We encountered that problem as well, and so we wanted to get ourselves all on the same page then make sure that when we ask the consultant to provide us data and information or do an analysis, that it was done under clear guidelines so that we continue to compare apples to apples each time we obtained information from folks. And we also learned that certain situations call for different measures or metrics. So we wanted to make sure that each time we were looking at new development and talking about government take, everything was on the same basis. And any time we were looking for existing mature fields, we were looking again at the same kinds of measures that are typically best applied for that.
Okay.
So Mr. Marks is going to walk through metrics and explain the different types and which ones we selected for which purposes. He's also going to give a brief overview of the two models that we had developed both internally and through use of consultants. Then we're going to step through with the second module is going to be presented by Mr. Vukert Benig, and he's with PFC, and he's going to describe for you the modeling that he did, which was quite intensive. And you know, as a non-economist, it made my eyes pop out, so we've told him to go easy on you this morning. And he will be going through approximately, you know, there's like 190 projects worldwide that he analyzed and assessed and was able to give us good comparable information. And then the third segment is going to be the wrap-up where we were able to pull together comparisons starting from the general of the whole world. We then narrowed our focus to a set of peer group countries that we felt were good comparables for Alaska, so that instead of scattering our focus, we wanted to zero in on three or four countries that we thought were good comparables and assess what they were doing, how they were doing it, how they set their tax structures up, and what it was that was continuing to drive investment to their shores, and then compare Alaska against that group, and so that you would have a very clear understanding of which elements within our tax structure were drivers or were important from the view of industry based on where they were in fact investing and how they were investing. So that you'll have a sense of importance or materiality in looking at the various features of our tax that if modified would either have a large effect or minor effects. And then, so I'll leave it there. So that's today. So I'd like to introduce Mr. Roger Marks with our department to go through the first phase of explaining our structure. Oh, yeah, actually, Roger is going to, from the outset, give something to you that you had requested yesterday, which was a brief side-by-side comparison of the economic pieces of PPT, the law of the land as it stands today, and ACES, which are the minor changes being made, and what their significance is. So you'll have this in your mind as you walk through today and understand what we call the different pieces that can change and either be material or not as material.
Do we have a copy of that?
Yes, that is second page.
Okay, I got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Marks. I'm an economist with the Tax Division in the Department of Revenue. The next 2 days, we're really kind of starting to talk about the economics of this proposed ACES bill. And we thought this would be an appropriate time to explain sort of how the mechanics of how the bill works, how it's different from the existing tax statute in terms of the mechanics of how the tax is calculated. Hopefully this will be especially useful for new legislators. Now, this is at a fairly high level. The details will be covered in the sectional analysis, so this is sort of at a high level. So what we're going to do is just talk about the mechanics of how the current PPT law works for the production tax and just what is being proposed under ACES and how it changes mechanically how the tax is calculated. We start out with the ANS West Coast price, and we subtract out the shipping and the pipeline tariffs, and that gets you to the gross value at the point of production. For people who, you know, who think about taxing at the gross, that's what we're talking about, the West Coast price less the shipping. It's sometimes called the wellhead value or the value of the oil at the lease boundary. And then what we do from there, in the way the PPT works now and the way ACES would work also, we subtract the upstream costs, upstream capital costs, and the upstream operating costs. And by upstream, we mean the costs that occur at the field to produce the oil. And on the capital costs, there's a 30 cent reduction in what, per barrel in what can be deducted to cover a corrosion issue. So when we get the gross value less the upstream costs, we're left with what is called the net income. And the way PPT works is the basic tax rate is 22.5% of the net income. What's being proposed under ACES is to elevate that to 25%. Now what we've put here to show you the magnitude of the difference revenue-wise, just what the different changes mean to revenue. And what we've done is model each of those at a $60 ANS West Coast price as if both of those were in effect the entire fiscal year 2008. The proposed effective date for ACES is January 1st, 2008, which would be in the middle of fiscal 2008. But just to get an apples-apples comparison of entire year, we've modeled them assuming they were in effect the entire fiscal year. So the difference, the 2.5% difference, is at $60 ANS West Coast, about $200 million. Then once the base tax rate is calculated, there's a progressivity surcharge which raises the tax rate depending on the per barrel net income value. Under the PPT, you calculate the per barrel net income value. If it's over $40 a barrel, for every dollar it's over 40, the basic rate increases by 0.25%. Under ACES, the what we call the kicker, that's the price at which progressivity starts, the per barrel net income. Under ACES, we've reduced the where progressivity starts from $40 to $30. And we've throttled
excuse
back.
Excuse me, Roger, if you're Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Yeah, this is the key thing a lot of folks have been talking about over the last couple of days. Why was the decision made? This was something we spent months on just a year ago. Why was the decision made to reduce that? We know that oil, you know, yesterday was $88.50, down from 90. Why, on the world assumption that it's going to be 80 to 100, why would we reduce that percentage?
Senator McGuire, the percentage of going from 0.25 to the 0.2 was made late in our analysis of the various knobs. Let me back up. Economic knobs, that was our shorthand term for as we worked through looking at the model that it was set up as with a rate, a progressivity that had a trigger and a price. And then as we ran each model against new field development and against existing field development, we looked at where it yielded the results that we have, we're going to present to you tomorrow, okay. Which was how attractive did those developments look to industry from a net present value standpoint. And so as we got more aggressive with the rate and as we were more aggressive with the trigger price, we saw trade-offs. And as we saw a diminishment of net present value to industry, there was the knob that we could turn that gave a slight change in an upward direction was the slope. And so once we put in the 10% gross tax floor, we again needed to give back something into the economic system, fine-tune another knob back up to make that trade or that balance be a little fairer over time. And that was one of the calls made. It looks counterintuitive, but when you're turning sort of the larger knobs more strongly in the direction of the state, we needed to fine-tune a few things. This was one that did it, because with the gross tax floor, there was a larger cut being taken of the main base revenue, and the slope slowed down at least the take from the top across the progressivity, across monies that were coming in at high prices. So it was just it's a balancing out of the pluses and the minuses of the way the variables.
Okay, just in wrap up, this is, I think, a point of big debate. Mm-hmm. Personally, I'd rather see the floor out mm-hmm. and 25%.
Understood. Yeah.
Senator Stedman.
While we're on the subject, Mr. Chairman, maybe when we come forward with some more data, you could show us the impact of progressivity changes over multiple price and volume changes, because one of the concerns we had as we looked at the original PPT bill was the government take percentage change, the marginal change, as prices advance, 60, 70, 80, 90 dollars a barrel, and over 100. And what we were trying to do is make sure that the state's percentage take, I'm not talking about dollars because that just gets down a rabbit trail, but looking at the percentage changes, where the state's take was declining and the industry take was escalating at extremely high dollars, so prices per barrel. So we need to come at it from that angle. But we also faced, from the legislative side, that balancing act of dealing with the knobs when we set the rate at 22.5 and we set the progressivity. So there was all, you know, as you referenced, these are all interconnected.
Yeah, I'd like to piggyback on that because that was the exact comment I was going to make, is that a stepped approach, and I'm not interested in really talking about it now, really rather look at models that you've done that gives a stepped approach to the progressivity as the price increases so we can see what that means to Alaskans and revenue and oh, by the way, what it means to the producers, if you will.
Absolutely, Senator Huggins. That methodical sort of analytical or logical approach is a good way to to see each piece and its impact.
Can I
Yes.
Or just what?
I'm sorry.
And I recognize we're just getting into the beginning of this, and this is the, you know, the space shuttle view of what we're dealing with. But one thing I'd like you to do is look at possibly rearranging how you lay it out. Because what you have here is you have your upstream capital costs coming out before your operating costs. When we look at the models and the numerics, I'd like to see your operating costs come out before your capital expenditures and the operating cost singled out, because we'll be looking at some of the historic real values and some of these projections. And as the industry changes due to price changes and their capital costs and lift costs, we want to try to take those into account. And then I'd also like you to take that 30 cents out, or at least have it line itemed in the capital cost, or preferably just take it out, put it underneath, or however you're going to do it, so we can isolate that. And then on your slides, make sure you note what you're dealing with as far as production and dollar values. So as we dig these out, as time goes on, we can figure out, you know, where these dollar values come from.
Right, and Senator Stedman, I assume when you say take them out, so that way when we're looking at, say, for instance, taking 2007 or 2008, putting values down the right side, you can see the magnitude or the size of each of those elements as you work through, so that way you can see what the 30 cents is and what these different pieces are.
Right. If we're working in dollars, I know we're going to be working in some hypotheticals as we're trying to deal with percentage changes, so we're going to have to modify that a little bit. But clearly we want to be able to delineate all these items. And also, when we get further down the road and we start getting into the capital, the credit swing in to decline the actual impact of the Treasury, we need to make sure that we are clear with the people of the state, if we're talking about pre-credit dollars coming in to the Treasury or the net. Because it gets very confusing to people if you don't take into account your credit impact when you're talking about the impacts to the Treasury versus if you talk about the credit impacts. And then we'll get into all the areas where you'll have trouble answering, is what is the credits, where do they come from, and all that. But we'll,
thank you.
And I know we're just in the beginning, but just trying to lay out some of the information, I think it'll make it easier for the committee.
Senator Stedman, those are very good clarifications. Again, just to make sure that we are absolutely clear and give you the best information you need to be able to look at it and analyze it. So thank you.
Okay, go ahead, Roger.
So with those changes on the progressivity mechanics, that's another $200 million that would add to revenues for FY08 under the proposal. Then once you have the base income and the progressivity surcharge, the tax payment is reduced by a series of credits, and there are five major ones. The first one is, and we're only proposing a change to one of those five, and that would be the transition credits, 023I. The capital credits, 023A, 20% of your capital expenditures is a credit. Again, the 30 cents per barrel is subtracted from that. 023B, the net operating loss credit, that's the credit where if you have a loss, you can convert your loss to a credit at a rate of 25% of the loss and monetize your credit immediately, or I guess I put over two years. That was to increase the net present value to investors that didn't have income that they could offset their losses with for new projects. What we're proposing to eliminate is the transition credits, 023I. Those were the credits that recognizes past spending between 2001 and 2006.
And that's classically producers. The clawback in the two for one.
That's what's called the clawback. We estimate removing that is another $200 million in FY08. There's the small producer credit. That's producers who produce 50,000 barrels a day or less in the state get a $12 million credit. That credit is throttled back as you produce between 50,000 and 100,000 barrels a day down to zero. At over 100,000 barrels a day, there is no 024 credit. And then finally, the exploration credits, 025. We're proposing some changes to those to cover delineation wells. We haven't really estimated the impact of that right now. But the bottom line is at $60 ANS under PPT, we estimate we'd get about $1.4 billion from production tax. Under ACEs, about $2 billion, so an increase of about $600 million. So that's a general high-level overview of the mechanics of what we're proposing.
Okay, Senator Wagner.
We did the transitional credits, or the, I call it kickback. People didn't like that. That's what it was. I was dead set against that until we came up with the two-for-one formula. It's hard probably for you to answer how did it work, because to order a lot of equipment and to get into that mode of spending $2 for every dollar in increasing production and doing capital expenditures, it probably wouldn't kick in the first year. Did you see, what were the results you saw of that?
Well, it was quite significant, on the order of $200 million or more. The way it essentially worked was if you had spent something like $500 million a year between 2001 and 2006, if you spent money in 2007, the way the two-for-one worked is basically you take 20% of your capital costs times, the two-for-one made it 20% times a half. So essentially, it was another 10% credit added on to capital spending. And so it was quite significant. Under the PPT, the state has a non-trivial amount of exposure to capital costs, in the order of through the deducting the capital costs and through the credits, that alone is 42.5% of the state's exposure to spending, and the tie credits add another 10%. So one reason we are proposing eliminating it is reduce our exposure to high costs. And the other issue is the argument about whether, the philosophical judgment argument about whether it's appropriate to give credits for past spending, which is, again, a philosophical issue.
Senator Wagoner, just I wanted to add one thing. Yesterday when I testified, I'm not sure if it was you who asked the question, but someone had asked sort of what the magnitude was of the tie credits that we had seen so far and whether they exceeded our expectation. I think I said $45 million. It's actually been $114 million in the first year that we've seen by way of credits claimed. And it's my understanding that was surprising to our staff that we were not expecting that high a number. And then with respect to the question as to, again, whether or not that two-for-one spend, you're correct that if monies were spent in reliance upon, taking that credit or making that credit,
what we don't, we aren't necessarily seeing the result of that by way of production or anything. It would potentially be too early. And even if we saw that spend and saw it compared to that TIE credit, we also don't know to what extent those same investments would have been incentivized just simply through the 20% capital credit program or some of these other programs. But I just wanted to make clarity that there, the number was a lot larger than we thought.
So in all probability, whatever happened between the time this bill went into effect and the time they took those credits, that would have happened anyway, because those capital items would have had to have been on order and in the process of either being built or being shipped.
Certainly for the first, yes, for this first year, yes, sir.
Okay.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. With the chair's indulgence, could you, I wasn't here yet last year. I understand most of what you have here, but I don't understand the credit section. Can you just briefly explain capital, NOL, TIE, small producer and exploration credits to me?
Sure. Okay, the capital 023A is a capital credit where if you spend $1 million in capital spending, you get a credit for 20% of that, $200,000 reduction in your tax.
Is that exploration, or is that, could that be maintenance on the pipes, or
it's all capital expenditures as defined by the IRS code in terms of what qualified capital expenditures.
So that doesn't necessarily encourage exploration.
That is correct. It could be capital spend where you're replacing a bit of equipment and maintaining existing production, or just simply it's anything that qualifies as a capital expense under the IRS code.
On the subject of exploration, there's also 025 is the exploration incentive credits. Now, if you incur capital costs for exploration, you can take your credit either under 025 or 023A, but not both. So there is quite a bit of capital involved in exploration as well. In addition, under 025,
how much is the exploration credit? That 20%?
Well, it depends under the current rule, depending on how far you are from other current downhole wells. It's either 20% or 40%.
Okay.
And then, well, do you want to finish talking about the credits?
Yeah, we have another question here from Senator Stebbins and then Senator Wagner.
Well, let me, before I ask my question, let me just add to this discussion here on the definitions. The Finance Committee during AGEA had asked the Commissioner of to come forward with kind of a synopsis of all the credits available to the industry. So there's about a 3 or 4 page letter out from Commissioner DNR that lays that out. So I'll go through my documents and I'll bring that to the committee. That way we'll have a quick reference page. The other thing I'd like to add, the question I had was back on the transition credits. We had those calculations run with the look-backs of 5 years, the two-for-one impact, so maybe we could have that information brought forward and we can look at the projections of what we were looking at the time, and then the what was claimed, and then look at the marginal difference and why there would be a difference, because as Senator Wagner said, a lot of these were sunk costs and the estimate that we had should have been fairly close, seeing how it was sunk costs. There's going to be a lot of denials through the auditing process of this $114 million.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about sort of what we call the cost story, what happened and when we were estimating costs and why our costs, the costs that actually turned out to be were different than what we estimated, why we think that happened. It turns out our estimates of the past spending were pretty good. Maybe they're about 15% off. So what we're seeing is on the amount of expenditures they spent between 2001 and 2006, the way the two-for-one works with their spending, with high costs that they're having now, they're recovering those past expenditures faster. Obviously, they can't recover through the TIE mechanism more than what they spent through 2001 and 2006. And actually, the TIE credit expires in 2013. So what we're seeing with the high costs we saw last year, what that did was mean they're recovering those past costs faster. But the costs themselves that are being recovered, we had a, you know, it turns out our estimate of what those were maybe 15% off, which is not, you know, given the big picture, is not too bad, we think.
And just one last one here, a brief, more or less comment on the credit, just for the folks watching at home. The credit wasn't put in PPT as a charitable endeavor by the people of Alaska to the industry. It was put in there to make it more expensive for the industry to take their net income out of the state, to encourage them to reinvest into the fields, to slow down or preferably stop the decline in production due to the coming fiscal gap between 3-4 years out, which we've pretty much cushioned for the first 3 or 4 years. But after that, to first gas, we're going to have a revenue shortfall, as we saw yesterday on the projections. And what we're trying to do is stimulate the oil patch, in particularly the Arctic, by putting some economic gas on the fire. So every year we're going to be asking you to come before the committee and talk about capital expenditures within the Arctic, and are we getting what we're driving for.
Senator Stedman, and that's a very good point, that this isn't something we do and walk away from, but it's something that you want to monitor and ensure that the pieces you put in place are performing the way that it was recommended they would perform and you wanted them to perform. And just, you know, not to beat a dead cow, but yesterday that is part of the motivation of our desire to get the heightened information so that we will be able to give you that information and give so that you're going to be able to ferret out of the spend that's happening, how much of it is attributable to simply higher cost, how much of it is attributable to increased spending levels on sort of new investment is what we're going to call. So you'll be able to see if you're getting that new investment rather than, as Mr. Marks suggested, you know, part of this accelerated recovery for past is actually attributable to just higher cost. That one widget now costs 150% of what it used to cost.
I'm going to just do one.
We'll get one more quick follow-up.
One quick follow-up, and this is more of a comment. If we look at the fiscal position of the state, now is the time to stimulate the Arctic. It's not going to be the time to stimulate it in 4 or 5 years when we have revenue shortfalls. Mm-hmm. We're running surpluses and putting money forward. So now is the time to take these hits on our net income with credits and try to drive the industry forward. Just kind of a give kind of people at home kind of a little broader picture of what we're trying to do.
Yes, Senator Wagner.
Yeah, help me with this. We had a lot of discussion 2 years ago on PPT when the bill first hit resources about a way to keep the companies from purchasing capital equipment, warehousing them in Alaska, taking the credit, and then drawing on that warehoused equipment to other areas. You remember any of that, Roger? We had discussions about that. I'm not sure we ever put anything in there that prohibited that. For instance, if a standard piece of equipment used in industry is a Solar turbine, that's a huge investment. There's nothing in this bill, I don't think, that prohibits somebody from buying 2 Solars, warehousing them in Alaska, and if they need them off the shelf, ship them out, and they've gotten the credit. I can't remember. We were talking about putting a fix in there, but I don't think we did.
Well, I remember in the macro some addressing of that because there was concern, but Senator Stedman was in the mix on that. Do you have a comment?
Yes, I recall a little bit of that, Senator Wagner, and that was a concern, along with the gold. You know, we had a discussion of gold plating faucets in Texas and so on and so forth. I think we addressed that. Hopefully you guys can go back to the records, or we can go to the records and check our data. But while we're having things on the table, we should certainly go back and glance at that, because that was a concern that there would be that a creative financing going on.
Mm-hmm. Let me finish my line of thought. So in my mind, the only way we can figure out if this did happen or not would be eventually through the audit process, correct?
That is correct, Senator Wagner.
And we'd be having to audit inventory, massive inventory sheets.
Yeah, and as part of the audit process, clearly you're going to, you know, target a spread of items, high-ticket items, and hopefully be able to see if there's a pattern of that kind of conduct.
Senator McGuire.
This will be, through the Chair, Marcia, so this will be part of when we discussed yesterday the new regulations and the new authority that we're giving you to really set out what are the types of expenditures that will be allowed. Mm-hmm. Those will be the kinds of things that can be contemplated. Where
Absolutely.
Someone's clearly, you know, warehousing, you know, the same item over and over again in order to get that, you know, time value of money and that deduction.
It, clearly, in the basic definition of what is leasehold expenditures, you're looking for that which is directly used in the, you know, in the development and operation of the oil and gas lease. So if something has been purchased but clearly is surplus, then the argument would be made that those that class would be not included until when and if placed in service or, you know, put into function.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Dr. Van Muir said that in some cases we have expiration credits of 60%, 70%, 80%. And I talked with Roger yesterday trying to figure out, and he said he didn't think that was accurate. Is that accurate to your knowledge?
In terms of exploration credits, some of them are additive. And in terms of taking the, I think the maximum exploration credit is a 40%. The capital credit piece, you can, there is also a 20% capital credit. So you can't use the same expenses with it that you applied against your exploration credit for that, but you can also get capital credit, so that takes you up to, you know, the 60%. Plus then if you actually have operating properties at the same time you're doing exploration, then conceivably you also have OPEX and CAPEX deductions against a tax rate of 22.5% currently. So I think that's where you start to see the large in an extreme case where someone is fully engaged with operations and exploration, you could see roughly the 82.5%, something in that range, where that level of offset is happening associated with a, quote, large project.
Well, and if I could just follow up. So, and I also understand that maybe there's an old law in the books that says you can take credits for some types of things. If you could address that. And also, have you looked at that? I mean, is it really in Alaska's best interest to have an 82.5% credit on some of these fields?
The example we gave there is probably the most extreme, and I'm not sure if anyone has actually got set up to put all those levers in motion at the same time. If they are, they're very, very active, and they're investing a lot of money. So right now, in terms of our analysis, when we look at explorers or the exploration process, we tend to look at the new entrants and the new players. The example I just gave you would be someone who's actually an existing player who's also aggressively going out and doing other operations. Again, each piece, if you look at it in its integrity, it is designed to deliver the production value to the state associated with that activity, with obviously the exception of, as you described, for capital costs, which may or may not be directly tied to creating production. Exploration is probably our biggest bang for the buck as far as actually creating new production, bringing on new fields. So we certainly don't want to give short shrift on the exploration side. If one were to be concerned about overcompensating, you know, then they'd be looking at the capital credits and the investment, the OPEX stuff associated with existing status quo production. But we have been very focused, and that's one reason we've expanded the exploration piece of it, because again, as Senator Stedman said, now is the time that where if we're going to take state dollars and target it and drive it back into the field, we want to try to target it toward places that are going to bring in skins and new production.
So just in wrap up, so when Dr. Van Muir said it only needs to be a 20% exploration credit, any more than that really isn't necessary. You disagree with
we
that?
We would disagree with that, yes.
Yeah, if I might, I've been remiss not recognizing Senator Thomas of Fairbanks joined us much earlier, and thank you for coming this morning on the Saturday. Roger, and Marcia first, I may have gotten the wrong impression that what we the delineation of deductions and credits, that we were getting this big clump and we didn't know what they were. And I heard you say on line 023 you pulled out a number in excess of $100 million, as I recall. Mm-hmm. My question, though, is if we can do that with 023, what's the answer for 025?
We can do that, and we do have estimates of it.
What is that answer,
025? I can't tell you off the top of my head. I'm the worst person in numbers, but we're actually going to have a separate presentation by Department of Natural Resources, who are the ones that are the guardians of sort of that exploration 025 understanding, because they're the ones that the explorers come to and lay out their plans to, and so they are in the best position to let us know what's actually being driven currently by the 025 and what's behind the desire to expand the 025.
Right. That's the first part. But I it's also my supposition that 025, no matter what that number is, it does not reflect the stimulus of PPT, because
it's too early.
It's too early. Is that, could you concur?
You know,
It's outside the whole budgeting cycle that would have brought about the activity.
We may right now be starting to see some of the activity associated with the 025, just as people look for the coming drilling season, because they're clearly doing it in contemplation of, you know, the credits that are there, the fact that they're refundable, because essentially the PPT, you had in place the 20% and 40% exploration credits before PPT was passed, but what's different now is it's actually refundable in the here and now. I mean, you're getting monies coming back, so. Or they're transferability, excuse me. They're not refundable, but they're transferable, so they can monetize them in the near term. And that's been the kicker that PPT has provided to explorers to date.
Right. Yeah, and my apology, the 025 is the exploration credit.
Right.
I'm sorry for
Yeah.
I'm talking in jargon here. Yeah. Your jargon.
Yeah.
What do you mean by 023 and 025 is 4355, 02, you know, 345. It's part of that.
I'll remember that for a long time.
Yeah. Just if I could, Roger. Just it's hard because watching the cameras on your back, and I don't know if the people at home can see the enough detail on your computer screen there to actually see when we refer to like 024. We're talking about small producers, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. Just so people at home could follow, because it's very difficult to follow it when we speak outside of the jargon, much less when we accelerate in the acronyms.
Well, and Marcia, just for a couple of constituents that have talked to me, but can we go back to the looking at the laydown you did here? And that, to me, that's not the full answer to the laydown of what we're doing here overall. But we'll talk about mm-hmm. that offline.
Right.
But as I look at the laydown you did, and thank you very much for that, Roger, and good work, that really is reflective, in my mind at least, and confirms what a couple of my constituents said. This is some amendments to PPT, what we're doing, this process we're going through. Is that
clearly we're not supplanting the existing net tax with a brand new net tax. What we're doing is staying with the net tax, staying then adding in what we've modified is the existing, and you'll see on this next slide, there's an existing floor that has a certain level of operation. We're taking that gross tax floor and essentially amplifying that.
Yeah, so we're taking the architecture of PPT and doing some amendments.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Yes,
thank you. Yeah, I still don't, you never said NOL in transition.
Oh.
If you could just briefly for me, tell me what those are.
NOL is what happens if you're a new producer and you're starting up a field.
Say what NOL stands for.
Net operating loss.
Okay.
And let's take an example where a producer in Alaska is taking advantage of this is the Ugaruk field. It's a gravel island field being built offshore now. It's going to, I think, start up production next year. Right now, as the company that's doing that,
Pioneer's building.
Given the cost they're spending to build that, they don't have very much offsetting income in Alaska. They're incurring a net operating loss within Alaska. In order to, the way PPT is structured, NACES is structured, we wanted to boost the net present value of projects to producers. And by doing that, you know, more money up front boosts the net present value. if generally under you know, most tax codes, IRS, if you have a loss, you carry the loss forward to next year. And then until that point where you have offsetting income, and that's when you sort of monetize your costs. Under the NOL mechanism, in order to maximize the net present value to the producers, if you have a net operating loss because you have no other offsetting income, you're a new small producer, you can take your loss, and under PPT, you can multiply that loss by 20% and get a credit for it. So you can monetize your loss immediately or very soon, and which boosts the net present value. So that's the net operating loss.
And then transition is just briefly.
Okay. Transition, the tie credits were put into place. When PPT was put into place in 06, there were some feeling that you know, producer, when you invest money, you invest today and you get the oil down the road. There were some people that felt that if you were a producer, somewhere in the period between 2001 and 2006, had you known the PPT was coming along and you were going to get credits for your expenditures, it may have made sense to defer those until PPT came into place. So the philosophy of the tie credits was to offset that issue. Some people thought it was appropriate, some didn't, but that's the philosophy behind it.
So is that the retroactive credits?
Well, it's not retroactive. It represents
clawback.
Retroactive
clawback.
Expenditures.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And you're eliminating that under ACES?
Yes.
Can I add something, Mr. Just on that, the discussion also revolved around the economic conditions at the time, or the tax conditions at the time, that the capital budgeting decisions were made to go forward over the last 3 or 4 years. And as we came in with a new tax regime, which was going to elevate the government take numbers to the state, there was also some discussion of that, well, of a fairness issue, where the decisions were made under ELF, which I think most of us would agree the state was at a disadvantage under ELF. But anyway, these capital budgeting decisions were made under ELF. Now they're going to be, by the time they're built and fully implemented, they're going to be under PPT, and there was a fairness issue. So we were trying to balance that and then deal with Cook Inlet and deal with the major producers and try to come up with some balance. So I don't know the easiest way to kind of bring some of the folks in the legislature that weren't in that debate up to speed, but we should have quite a record built on that. I think the Resources Committee spent several meetings going, taking that issue around and around.
Yeah. Roger, just to jump back very quickly, and I'm sorry, Senator Wojcicki.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the explanation.
I have one last question
But if I could, just a follow-up on that part. The net operating loss, in my mind, is a powerful tool from the perspective of the state of Alaska for future production. Do we agree on that?
It's net present value benefits are material.
Right. I'm looking at the Deputy Commissioner.
Yes, sir.
Okay, all right. Okay, good. I mean, I'm trying to make sure philosophically we're on the same page.
Yeah. One of the things I've heard I agree. I mean, with NOL, it seems like we want to encourage new producers to come on because we only have three. But one of the things I've heard is that facilities access is very difficult. It's really difficult for new producers to get in because they can't have access. Have you explored doing any kind of facilities access changes in ACES?
Senator Wojcicki, definitely facility access is an important piece of the overall puzzle because this structure is around the tax structure. You know, there really isn't a way to tie facility access to tax structure. If the legislative body wants to address that issue, it's going to need to do it in separate legislation. You know, that would probably be more along the lines of involving the Department of Natural Resources, which does the facility approvals and has to do the permitting for the lands and everything else, because then it becomes more of a state policy decision making about regulating surface facilities, environmental impacts, et cetera, you know, looking at the market it's probably the same reason why, you know, as far as pipelines and things like that, how you regulate access to infrastructure that's on state lands is a completely different body of law than what we would be doing with the tax system. You know, that's not to say I haven't heard discussions about it, because clearly when you sit down and you start to brainstorm, what can we do as a state to improve the ability of new players to come in, and even actually existing players, because frankly you've got owners of infrastructure who are in place and are ready to step out and do exploration, and they want to turn around and say, hey, buddy, old pals, partners, I'd like to bring my field in. They have the same impediments that a new entrant would. So it clearly is an issue that's sitting out there, and but it would need to be dealt with outside the context of this bill.
Would that, from what I understand, it would really significantly encourage investment in Alaska if we were to make it easier for smaller producers to get in through facilities access. Is that fair to say?
Well, clearly it's a very, very important economic consideration by someone coming in, and if they're going to invest a lot of money in doing a resource development, the means to have that infrastructure in place to process and develop and then ship it down the line is always critical.
So. Yeah, and we have given, the committee has given revenue in this case, a deputy commissioner warning order that we're going to have that conversation.
Okay.
That's an important conversation to have, and we should not gloss over it today and just say we're going to defer on it.
Right.
We're not going to defer too long on it.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, through the chair. Last question on this particular chart. Marcia, I think you indicated that you had modeling that you'd maybe present tomorrow, the next day, mm-hmm. on the progressivity surcharge.
Yes.
And if not, in
yes.
preparation, I would like to see the 0.25% at 30.
Okay. Okay, and the chair would like to recognize Senator Hoffman of Bethel. Welcome, Senator Hoffman. Okay. Go ahead, Roger.
Okay, next. And in terms of summing up how the mechanics...
Roger, if you introduce sure. this slide, and then we're going to take a 10-minute break, because I think we're going to have to make some adjustments on our schedule here potentially, but we're going to huddle here quickly to see where
okay.
we're going on our timeline.
I wanted to very briefly discuss what's been changed between PPT and ACES and how the floor mechanism works. Under PPT, the floor was the higher of your PPT net tax payment, or depending on the West Coast price of oil, a percentage of gross income. At West Coast prices of 25 and above, it's 4% of gross income. So you compare those two, you pay on higher of. How the credits interact with the floor is complicated. We're going to leave that to the sectional analysis to get into that. But that's generally how it works under PPT. Under ACES, the proposal is to limit the floor mechanism to those units that have produced cumulatively over 1 billion barrels of oil and are currently producing over 100,000 barrels a day, which is basically the Prudhoe Bay unit and the Kuparuk River unit, limit the floor to those two fields, and the floor would be the higher of your ACES net tax payment, or 10% of the gross value at the point of production. Again, how the credits interact is it's a little bit complicated, and we'll leave that for the sectional analysis, but that's just a general overview of what's been proposed on changing the floor.
And let's let that sit there, and we'll reconvene into a quarter to. And there's good reason for that. For each of you, I know it's important, and you're concerned about this because the Alaska State Football Championship will be determined this afternoon, starting at 1:00. So that means, since Palmer is playing Juno at 1:00, we will be done by 1:00. It'll be televised. So for anybody who's worried about getting out of here at some certain time, at 1:00, we will walk out the door. So Marcia, your challenge to get your...
That's right. Whip them.
Okay. With that, Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to shift direction here. What we want to spend the bulk of the remainder of the presentation today talking about is fair share to government. Talk about what that means, how we view it, We've taken some different approaches that have than have been taken in the past. We believe these are sound. What we want to do is explain why we took these approaches and explain our vocabulary and just you know, what we did and why we did it. A sound fiscal system needs to be a balance between the interest of the government and the interest of investors. Investors need competitive returns. And tomorrow we're going to talk about how ACES affects things from the investor side of things. Dr. Tony Fenizza will be addressing that. Today we want to talk about how ACES impacts on fair government share. And from the government side of things, you know, fair share to government is the goal of the fiscal system. Now, what do we mean by fair share to government? Well, the world is a competitive place, and investors can put their money in a variety of places. And what we mean generally by fair share to government is that the government gets the portion of the value of the projects relative to what other governments are getting, commensurate with the business risks in those different countries. And let me give an example. Geologically, one of the best places in the world to do business is Angola. They have this spectacular geology there. But as we all know, Angola is politically unstable. But it turns out that what investors, in terms of what we mean by business risks, looked at relative costs, relative geology, business risks, government take, fiscal stability. When you put all those together, that's business risk. What the investment community seems to put it, and not all those are weighted evenly, what the investment community seems to put a premium on is geology, just how much oil you're going to get out of there, because that's what determines how much money you're going to get. So the way the world works is, even though Angola, they take a much higher share of the value of the projects than we do, they can do that. They're less politically stable. But because the wealth there is so great, investors are willing to put up with a lot to do that, to do business there. And it would not be appropriate for Alaska to compare itself to Angola in measuring how much the value of the project we should get. It needs to be relative to our business risks. And later today, Dr. Williams is going to discuss Alaska's relative business risks and what sets of jurisdictions he thinks we ought to compete with. The next principle is you know, when we talk about fair share, we use the word metrics. And what metrics means is sort of the statistics to measure whether or not the government is getting an appropriate amount of the value of the project. And since it's a comparability concept, the measure needs to be an objective measurement that can be systematically compared with other jurisdictions. Then the final principle I want to talk about in the approach we took is that new fields are different from legacy fields in measuring fair share to government. The basic difference between new fields and legacy fields or mature fields, new fields, what's going forward, you have the whole life cycle of the field. You're going to have investment and then recovery of oil over the entire life. That's a forward-looking concept. With legacy fields that are in the middle of their life, the life cycle concept doesn't apply. In addition, you can't look at individual years, and there's two reasons why. If you look at the pattern of development in oil or any production activity, first you spend money, and then you get the fruits of the investment. And looking at any individual,
Roger, just so that for clarification for all Alaskans. In subsequent years, would you give us a number that rings what the investment cycle is to get first oil in a median scenario?
You know, it varies. I would say something, after you've decided, after you've done all the exploration and after you've done the evaluation,
first investment is when you throw your dollars there,
right,
and start, you know, the schematic of we're going to start exploring here. So it's not... So it's that full cycle. So from that cycle to when you have first oil, roughly
10 years would not be an unreasonable number.
Yeah.
So the reason you can't look at individual years on legacy fields to measure fair share is that you have the pattern of develop, you spend money and then you get oil. And whether you may be looking at a year where you spent the money, or you may be looking at a year where you get the oil, looking at an individual year, any individual year, will not give you a representative picture of what the government's getting. In addition, measurements need to recognize that investments decisions are based on forward-looking economics. If I have spent $1 billion years ago, and I'm evaluating whether I want to spend $1 billion now, I can't go back and re-spend $1 billion I already spent. The only question is, does it make sense to spend $1 billion going forward, and what does that do to me? So accordingly, we're looking at ACEs as a way to promote investment, and looking at what's gone on in the past is really not appropriate in terms of decisions that are going to be made in the future. So let's talk about legacy fields and new fields in a little bit of detail.
Roger, while you're changing slides, we'd like to welcome Senator Davis. Welcome this morning.
Okay, again, the thing about new fields is that all costs and all revenues and all activity are prospective going forward. And you can capture all the activity that's going to happen in that field going forward. And for new fields, we can use the concept that everyone calls government take. And when people use the word government take, what they're talking about is a life cycle concept. Marcia used the term cradle to grave, where you look at the entire life of the project, when you spent, when you got the oil. And what we mean by take is the percentage of the economic rent going to government. And by economic rent, we mean gross revenues less the cost. It's the pre-tax income. Some people call it the visible income, or it's sort of the profit before you pay taxes. And many economists, when they're looking at the rent or measuring the rent, they discount the numbers. And that's because the timing of government revenues matters, both to the investor and both to the government. Getting $1 billion now and getting zero 10 years from now is much different from getting zero now and $1 billion in 10 years. So we discount the numbers. And we discount them at 10%, which we believe is the current cost of capital in making investment decisions. Now, because when you discount something, the effects, the outcome you get is affected by timing, because many fiscal systems, including Alaska, have some front-end loaded elements, the royalty and the property tax particularly, you pay those before you start recovering any costs. When you discount, you're going to get higher government take than if you don't discount. Now, most of the numbers people have been looking at over the last few years are undiscounted, and so the numbers we're going to be presenting are higher than what you've been seeing before, and that's because, one reason is because of the discounting. Now, legacy fields are much different. The costs have already been incurred. And again, measurements that look at the cash flow in the single year could be deceptive. Again, the pattern of development is first you spend money, then you get the fruits of that investment. And large costs are often incurred in discrete time frames. I call it the lumpiness of spending. You spend a bunch of money, and then you get the oil over a series of years. In addition, even in these mature fields, there's investment going on all the time. So a single year cannot depict the economic picture. If you spend $1 billion now and get $1 million next year, if you just look at the year you got the million and say, wow, that looks great, without recognizing you spent a billion years prior to get that, you don't have an accurate picture of what happens. And again, looking at a single year and comparing with other international situations could be deceptive. And just taking Prudhoe Bay, for example, if you tried to take this life cycle concept, again, two reasons why it wouldn't work. One, the investment decisions are going forward. And two, you know, Prudhoe Bay, they've been spending money there for 40 years. You really couldn't recreate what was spent over the last 40 years. So what we do, and what many economists do, in trying to measure fair share to government for legacy fields is what we call the marginal tax rate, or the share of the incremental dollar going to the government. And the way this is derived, you take a price, so let's say we take $60, and you look at the total per barrel amount of money going to the government is $60. In the case of Alaska, that would be the property tax, the royalty, the production tax, the state corporate income tax, and we're looking at total government share because you're an investor, you don't care whether you're paying money to the federal government or Alaska, so we also include the federal corporate income taxes. So you look at, on a per barrel amount, how much is going to the government at a price, and then you increase the price by $1, and you see how much is going to the government at $1 more, and the difference is how much other revenue is how much the government is getting as the price goes up a dollar, and that's what we call the marginal tax rate. In addition, the reason we do that is by increasing the price by a dollar, we're not affecting the costs at all. We're just saying we're taking the exact same situation, increase the price of a dollar, and so we've minimized this lumpiness of cost issue. Now, many people over the years have asked the department, they're interested in what they call the share. In 2007 or 2006, you know, what share of the pie did Alaska get in 2007 or 2006? And this is a number that is based on cash flow in a single year. We've been giving that number out for years. The administration asked for it, certain legislatures asked for it, the public asked for it. We've been giving it out, but we don't like it. We don't think it's an appropriate number because measuring share based on a single year can ignore this lumpiness of capital problem. And so we give it out to people. We prefer not to. We don't think it's the way to look at things. We believe the marginal tax rate for mature fields and the take figure for new fields.
Roger, if I could, just at that point, since you're talking about lumpiness and a one-year snapshot, on the negative side, and people have reminded me of this on multiple occasions, that's in fact what we're doing. PPT has been around for less than a year when we started the review process. And I'm sure, hopefully you'll answer that at some point in time as we go along, but that's a question that many people ask about whether what we're doing here is premature because we are lumping 1 year, or less than 1 year, actually. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. So what I'm going to lead, after me, Torsten is going to be up here, and sort of leading into his presentation is we've asked Torsten to look at worldwide data on government take for new fields and marginal tax rate for existing fields. And the way we've organized it and try to focus on what is Alaska's relevant competition group or peer group, the world, which is usually in many ways a chaotic place, in this regard, it happens to be fairly, the world organized itself in a fairly orderly manner. There are two basic types of ways that governments collect revenues around the world. One is called the tax and royalty regimes, and one is called generally production sharing contracts. And the tax and royalty regimes are regimes in developed countries with stable democratic governments and diverse economies, basically the Western developed countries. And in those basic countries, the taxes are administered by statute, and they're broad-based. They generally apply the same rules, to everyone. Of course, there are some exceptions and some, deviations from that, but it's basically a broad-based, statute-driven system. In the production sharing contracts, these are in developing countries, less stable governments. The fiscal system is actually administered by contract, which we can't do here. They're in jurisdictions where the other methods of collecting revenue may be a little bit shaky, and they're in basically the oil-centered economies with better geology. And production sharing contracts basically are where the fiscal system is a negotiated contract between the government and an oil company, and it's negotiated field by field, the regimes.
A question from Senator Stedman.
I think, Roger, maybe we need to take a look at this issue and go into it a little deeper, because my recollection is the tax and royalty regimes are like you said, based in more democratic and stable political environments, which happen to also coincide a lot of times with the earlier oil development, and the later oil development in the late 60s and on in the 50s and 40s or what have you seemed to be the surfacing of these production sharing contracts. And my recollection from the previous testimony under PPT is the tax and royalty regimes were basically in, concentrated in North America. And when we moved out of North America and we looked on a global environment, we run into a lot of production sharing or profit sharing contracts, which were, an evolution time frame of how to deal with the industry was a newer versus older.
Yeah, Senator Stedman, generally, I think you've given a pretty good description. The tax and royalty, also not just North America, but we've seen, found some in South America, right. And obviously Europe, you know, in that specter. Dr. Williams is going to have a map, and we'll look at that in a little more detail to get flavor on sort of the specter and how widespread these are.
And yeah. Maybe we can do a time frame on that, or maybe I'll just give him a little warning. We'll talk about a time frame of this evolution of profit sharing and production sharing contracts.
Sure, and I think the evolution is, as you've stated, early oil, first oil tended to be in these more developed old world countries. That's where the oil companies actually were born out of those countries. And obviously they went at and targeted that oil. And so as those resources have been being used up and discovered and there's no more big prizes to be left in what I'll call the old world, they've stepped out to these developing nations, and that's why these large, exciting prospects are suddenly coming onto the market now, because they're stepping out. So you're correct that from an evolutionary standpoint, we are now seeing more of the production sharing arrangements arising, because that's where the remaining oil is. It's probably the remaining oil because there were a lot of risks associated with developing it compared to old world. And so clearly there's a trend right now in terms of companies dealing more and more with production sharing arrangements, because that's where they have to go to find the oil.
And isn't tax and royalty systems regressive for production sharing and profit sharing contracts?
Not necessarily. No. I mean, right now, even amongst the production tax, the tax and royalty systems, the world is essentially doing it on a net basis. I think the U.S. is one of the exceptions in terms of having growth systems. So as far as a net being a progressive system.
Right. Let me kind of finish my question.
Okay.
The question is, isn't royalty and tax more of a regressive system versus profit sharing and production more of a regressive system before you start making tweaks the last decade or so on some of these tax and royalty systems that counteract a declining government share in advancing this prices? And clearly the last several years we've had huge price escalation in the oil industry.
You're correct that the production sharing arrangements by and large have been structured to be very progressive, in the sense that the companies generally are able to recover their cost, on the upfront side, in exchange for much larger shares for the governments once the costs have been recovered. So there's probably more flexibility in the context of the production sharing agreements to get that kind of structure than under tax and royalty systems.
Let me just do one clarification for the people listening so they're clear of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. When we talk about a progressive system, is progressive from my viewpoint is the government share increases as we go to $50, $60, $70, $80 or some advancing range of oil prices, where regressive, your percent, not in dollars, but your percent of government take declines mm-hmm. as we get into these advancing price environments. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what
and also under the production sharing agreements, they frequently have the linkages to price as well. So again, there's that ability to negotiate in contracts more progressive features for their specific field or their specific structure. Under old world tax and royalty systems, as you described, they have to start coming in later in time and start to build in features that make them more progressive and more net and responsive, as we have attempted to do with PPT by adding a progressivity factor and allowing net offsets of real costs, et cetera.
Yeah, Senator Walkowski.
Thank you. So royalty and production tax is company comes in, pays a percentage of the royalty, and then they're allowed to go ahead and produce, and once they produce, then they pay production tax.
Correct.
That's like what we have now?
Correct.
Production sharing contracts is, can you just briefly, what is a production sharing contract?
A production sharing contract is essentially a contract between a government and a private party, an oil company. And they typically are directly focused on a field, a specific development, wherein there is a consideration given where the company is agreeing to perform certain conduct, which would be the level of development, the timing of that development, the scope of that development. It may involve things beyond the oil development itself. It may involve contributing infrastructure or making contributions to other aspects of the governing, you know, the government. And the government in turn agrees to provide essentially, it has the terms embedded in it for how both costs get shared, revenue from the sales get shared, where the product itself gets shared, all of the elements that we currently cover by royalty, property tax, the tax system in separate bodies of law are rolled up in this one contract. So it's a one package deal.
Okay, thank you.
And we have reinforcements coming to the table.
Good morning, sir.
I get it. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I can just agree with what has been said so far, and we will see when
put
I present my...
Put yourself on the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hey, just your name. It's on.
Okay, it's on? All right. And we will see when I present the numbers that indeed PSAs have the tendency...
Yeah, just put your name.
Oh, Torsten Wolfing with PFC Energy. I'm sorry. I'll introduce myself formally once I'm up at the presentation
right.
desk.
Right.
And we will soon present the numbers that PSCs, PSAs have the tendency to be more progressive, whereas tax royalty systems are indeed degressive or regressive as oil prices increase. So what we suspected is actually the case.
Okay.
And responsible for that is the royalty portion in the tax royalty regime.
But I mean, PSCs aren't necessarily a bad thing, are they? I mean,
you
could have, in a royalty production tax, you could have progressive elements, and you could have tailored to specific fields.
Absolutely. Right now, because most in old world, the contracts for development, at least in the United States, their construct, the lease is the contract, and it sets up the right to the royalty. And that those are instruments that, once in place, don't get modified without parties agreeing. So in Alaska, we're dealing with a lot of contract. The contract portion is locked in the royalty structure. To the extent that we are looking ahead into the future and saying, okay, we're going to enter into new leases, certainly it's the prerogative of the state to decide, looking across at production sharing agreements, et cetera, what elements would we like to import into our lease agreements in the future that might add progressive elements, more progressive elements to them, or different kinds of elements. So we have that contracting freedom within the context of future leasing.
But on the other hand, in my mind, I think in probably a number of Americans and Latins in particular, the production sharing contracts, places like Venezuela and Hugo Chavez come to mind. Is that mm-hmm. unfair? Is it?
No, in the sense that clearly that's part of the downside of working in a developing country that doesn't have, you know, a strong legal tradition, you know. And so it isn't so much an indictment of the PSC structure, it's more an indictment of the underlying political structure
right.
and its stability.
Yeah, and there are probably lots of reasons, but I guess the one that comes to mind is Yukos, and as mm-hmm. I recall in Russia, where the guy that ran that, I think we can't hear from him very well because evidently he didn't agree with some things. But there's a downside if you have to do the production sharing part of it mm-hmm.
yeah.
in some locations.
No, absolutely. Having a contract still puts you at risk of having to find a forum to enforce your rights under that contract.
Right.
Yes.
So moving on, it is you know, our judgment that in evaluating how to look at Alaska's fair share in compared to our relative other jurisdictions with our relative business risk, that we believe Alaska is in the category of the tax royalty jurisdictions, which includes basically UK, Norway, Gulf of Mexico, and Alberta as the relevant peer group in terms of our business risks. And again, Dr. Williams is going to talk up in detail about the relative business risk between Alaska and those jurisdictions. Under both PPT and ACES, as we will show, both the Alaska government take new fields and the marginal tax rate on existing fields lies between UK and Norway.
But just to flash that forward, if my I'm assuming that you're going to recommend that we stay in the category that we're in.
Yes, I mean, ACES by design is essentially staying where PPT is, and we're still talking about looking solely at the production tax system, not stepping out.
So in conclusion, what we'd like to emphasize is sort of the fundamental changes that we've taken from past efforts in looking at fair share to government. For one, the database. By hiring PFC, we have a more exhaustive inventory of international jurisdictions. I think the efforts in the past looked at a small number of countries, and PFC has done a fairly exhaustive job at looking at several of them. In addition, a lot of the past efforts looked at what I call generic projects. They took the same project and see how it behaves in the fiscal system in Venezuela, and the same project and see how it behaves in Angola, and the same project, see how it behaves in Alaska. Well, that's not how the world works. Each place, its projects are a result of its geography and its geology. And so what we've done is look at real projects. And what we've discovered, we've done a lot of internal work ourselves, is that trying to model individual projects is a fairly daunting task. Getting the fiscal system is not too bad, but getting the details of the costs and the production is quite a labor-intensive effort. And again, that's one reason we retain PFC, because they have a huge database that can do that. In addition to beef up our own internal prowess along this line, we've procured the Schlumberger PEAT model, which has worldwide detailed fiscal systems around the world, and we're doing the work internally to model individual projects. And again, in addition to the database, the other fundamental change in our approach is number one, we're recognizing the difference between legacy fields and new fields. And number two, we're comparing ourselves to what we think is the relevant competition. The idea of comparing ourselves to worldwide average we don't think is appropriate, because the fair share is a product of your relative business risks. So that concludes my presentation. With that, I think I'm going to just
switch. We have a question for you from Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't understand why we break it down and compare it to one as opposed to both. I mean, if I'm an oil company, I probably want to go where I'm going to make the most money, where I'm going to get the most favorable conditions, and where I'm going to have the most certainty in terms of government. So I guess I don't fully understand why you just wouldn't compare them to all of them. Because if you talk about investing in Angola, it's production sharing, but they're going to make maybe good money there. Isn't it really all net present value or internal rate of return? Isn't that what it really comes down to?
In terms of what we can do within our systems, frankly, the production sharing agreements, as they sit out there right now, have, by and large, their government take is between 70% to 90%. I mean, they're high. And they're high because, one, they've got the geology, and two, they're high because they have the flexibility within their systems to essentially deliver return of capital, sort of. They can structure it so that there's a big prize for companies coming in to recover their costs quickly, and the give up for that is then the government takes a much larger share. When we look at what we have within the range of possibility for us in Alaska, and as Senator Huggins asked us to clarify, we are not coming in here and saying we want to wipe the slate clean and create that structure. We can't create that structure from whole cloth right now, because we are set up with property taxes, royalties, income taxes, production taxes. There's a federal tax take on top of it. So we have this structure that we're right now talking about changing one of those four elements, just the production tax part of it. And within that band of possibility, when we make that change and we ask ourselves, okay, so what does that do to us relative to the rest of the world? We're not really changing where we stand relative to Angola or Azerbaijan or some of these countries that have the PSC. And we're trying to get a much finer focus on what we're doing to our competition that's right at our elbows, the ones that are within sort of the shooting distance. So if there were a customer, an investor that was going to be circling overhead. They would be circling overhead and looking at us versus Norway, us versus Gulf of Mexico. They wouldn't be going, should I be in Alaska or should I be in Azerbaijan? Because that frame of reference is they'll be, if they're interested in Azerbaijan, they're going to be over there, and nothing we can do with production tax is going to make a difference. And so what we tried to do is at least let you know the zone of what we were truly influencing by way of our relative ranking competitively with countries. And that's not saying, I mean, you're absolutely right. If someone says, gee, I'd rather be in Azerbaijan, they're going to be in Azerbaijan because they've made an evaluation on the geology and whether our government take is 66% or 68% or 62% isn't going to make a difference. And so I guess what we're trying to do is say what we can influence here today does change how we stack up to our nearest and best competition. It'd be like, I guess, Walmart, whether or not they did something, they wouldn't worry about how that affected their competition with, say, you know, Saks or you know, some high-end store. You've got to look at who your competition really is in terms of if your customer's going to walk up and they're really thinking about, should I go to Kmart, should I go to Walmart, should I go to Costco, should I go to Sam's? If someone's going to actually be looking at different criteria or different mix of attractants, you're not going to, what we do today, we don't want to waste your time and make those comparisons.
And maybe I can get together with you later. It just doesn't make any sense to me that, because all the big three invest in both production sharing and royalty and production tax.
Yes, they do.
And I have a difficult time believing that they sit down and say, well, okay, we're going to invest more in Alaska or Norway versus Angola. I mean, do they break it down and say, we're, you know, do they look at it as two separate worlds?
They actually, some of them have used the term sector or vector investments. And what you're going to see in the discussion today is there's several factors. And some of they weigh in political risk. They weigh in the value of the oil and gas itself, the cost to develop. They clearly are driven by the net present value of the project. But on top of it, you may have a huge prize there. But the political risk is so high that you don't want to bet the whole farm. So you're going to actually put some there, but you're also going to go to the more stable. It's like when you invest your 401k. You're going to have a certain amount of bonds. You're going to have a certain amount of you know, the high-risk, high-rolling stock. You're going to diversify your portfolio so that you're covered. And Alaska plays a role in that investment pattern. We're not going to be the high-flying investment. We're going to be something in the more stable region. And since that's the sector we're with, we want to look at the other stable guys and go, how do we get to the top of that pack so that we do bring in those dollars? And that's why we, there's no question there's the other competition for the other dollars, but what we influence most directly right now is that in our class, what I'll call.
In addition, I mean, if you look at, compare the total deal you're getting between a production sharing contract and a tax and royalty. In a production sharing contract, you're getting very good geology, and you're getting a contract, you're getting your fiscal system nailed down in a contract in exchange for paying a higher share in government take. We can't offer that deal. We can't offer the geology. We can't offer fiscal stability. We went through that last year with the gas contract. There may be limited situations where you can do it, but in general, we can't administer your taxes by contract. So we can't offer this in terms of the total deal, what you give and what you give up, we can't match that deal with a country that's giving very low geological risk and fiscal certainty through a contract.
The other one, for those who watch television, those less stable governments, one of the traits you see on TV is they carry Kalashnikovs, better known as AK-47.
Yes, yes. That's correct.
There's a very distinct difference. Mr.
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Stebbins.
Maybe before we jump on, or maybe even later, when we have our selection here, our comparison of the universe of UK and Norway, Gulf of Mexico, and so on. Could you go back and look at the different comparisons we've had over this whole PPT process? It seems like every time we bring a new consultant in front of us, they have a different comparison universe. And some of these are reoccurring within the universe. Some universes are much broader. Some people want to just compare Arctic or very remote regions. Some people want to compare Gulf of Mexico where there's no state take.
Yeah, no, there's no question that you can frame the debate by choosing what your comparables are. And depending upon the purpose of that comparison, you know, who you compare yourself to affects how you evaluate yourself. And in fact, I think Senator McGuire raised that yesterday. She said, well, I hear you comparing to other countries. You know, we're part of the United States, so on what you were interested in, you want to hear what the United States was doing. So clearly, what you're trying to understand derives to some extent what makes good logical comparisons. And so for us, what we tried to do is truly look at the group that we were seeing that we really, you know, as I said, elbow to elbow, who are the ones that we were bumping up against in terms of where the dollars were. And we think we've come up with this peer group. And we wanted to make it as broad as we could, give you as much data points as we could, but without stepping outside the bounds of that zone. So that's why we were looking at Norway, the UK, Gulf of Mexico, Alberta. These were the countries we kept bumping up into as being comparable on so many of the factors that the companies would be looking at. But what we also don't want to do is there are tendencies for consultants who are very bright and have gobs of data to slap up slides that, and we're going to 100 countries on it. And you know, when you see something like that, it's interesting, but your head starts to spin because some of those you look at and say, never in a million years are we going to be in the same sort of, you know, no one's going to be sitting going, should I go with Turkmenistan or Alaska? You know, I mean, there'll be some choices that they will make and some choices they won't. So we want to try to be productive and stay efficient and look at the realistic choices that are out there.
So let me finish my statement.
Mm-hmm.
Or question.
Okay.
So we'll have before the committee a comparative universe of the other consultants. So we seem to...
Which consultants are you referring to?
We can go back to the PPT environment when we
mm-hmm.
did that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a whole discussion here on the global universe and what basins, oil basins, should we be comparing to Gulf of Mexico, Saudi Arabia. There's two extremes.
In the last...
Like that. Okay, so let me
mm-hmm.
finish.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see the evolution over time mm-hmm. as our benchmark of mm-hmm. Field comparisons have been presented in a multitude of ways to the committee, mm-hmm. our members. And the other thing, when you talk about the capital budgeting environment, which is or your competitors here, is this information coming out of the boardrooms of the three major companies, or you can throw in Chevron for that matter, or is this just a subjective interpretation, or are we getting direct feedback from Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips that these are competitive oil basins that they look at when they do their capital budgeting?
Okay. On the first point that you made, I assume it was that you're asking that we, in the PPT debate, come back with the comments that were made by consultants regarding comparables
right.
for oil basins, et cetera, just to have a frame of reference of who we were being compared to previously, and then so we can see where we have evolved to today. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. And then on the second question, you're asking us to detail sort of the source of our information when we make statements about what an oil company or what the oil companies are contemplating by way of investment. Are these our conjecture? Are these is this information we're deriving from oil company records? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
So when BP sits down, and just I was thinking back of the testimony from them at the finance table, there was quite a bit of discussion on the capital budget.